Cosworth is a little company founded in London in 1958 by two Lotus employees, one Mike Costin and Keith Duckworth. From an experimental partnership, these two managed to alter the course of automotive history, both on and off the track. Between 1968 and 1974, every single Constructors' Championship in F1 was won by the same Cosworth engine, the DFV. And in 1969 and 73, every single F1 race was won by a DFV-powered car. This one engine was responsible for F1 wins across four decades, the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. But who the hell is Cosworth? What's their magical formula? And most importantly, how did two gentlemen engineers in suits manage to create an engine-tuning empire that changed racing for decades? Today on Pass Gas, it's part one of our two-part series on Cosworth.
Pass Gas Podcast, it's about cars, it's not about forts!
What's a Duckworth? Oh, that'll be costing you a fortune. Huh?
That's a really specific joke.
That's how I remember their names. What's a duck worth? That duck will be costing you a fortune.
I feel like ducks are probably pretty cheap, though.
Probably. Depends on what kind of duck you're into.
Yeah. Normal one.
You can get a crispy duck on New Year's Eve for $30.
Oh, I love crispy duck. Cause it's worth it.
It's worth it. I've only had duck once. Where are we on duck? Duckworth, Cosworth, Costin. My name is Nolan Sykes. Sitting across from me is one James Pumphrey.
Give me back my son! Give me back my son!
Trying it out.
And Joe Weber.
What's up, Wink Wink Nation? Let's keep it slimed up.
Ooh, get it goosed.
You can't say.
I don't know what happened.
And that sultry anchor Hello. Tone that Hello. You hear in the beginning, that was Nolan Sykes.
Go ahead and goose it.
Oh, nice. Mm. Damn, dude, that's sexy.
Nice. Mm.
That's sexy, yeah. dude. That's some, good. Some zaddy stuff.
Yeah, that was some zaddy
like
stuff.
Like you're sitting in an armchair like Arnold in True Lies. Yeah. yeah. And Jamie Lee Curtis is dancing, and you're mm-hmm. like, go ahead and goose it. Yeah. Go ahead and goose it for me.
What does that even mean?
Slower.
Slower.
Go ahead and goose it. Go ahead and goose it for me.
I watched the Arnold movie over Christmas break.
Which mm-hmm. one?
Jingle All the Way.
Ah.
Oh, I've good never one. Seen it.
Classic. Yeah. I think it's going to
Does he play Buff Santa?
I think it will. No, he plays a father who's just running around town trying to get a toy for his kid.
He plays
Turbo Man.
It's one of Arnold's most normal mm-hmm. roles. It's like
when he crushes it.
Yeah, it's that point in his career when he's like, I don't want to just be an action star. Yeah. I can just be a dad.
I have to put on a business suit.
Phil Hartman's in it as like the neighbor, annoying neighbor. It's like,
nice.
He's so, yeah. he's oh, so Phil Hartman's good. So, good. Yeah. so funny, man.
But there's a moment in Jingle All the Way where like Arnold is in disguise. So the whole movie, he's trying to find this action figure for his son that's like a Tickle Me Elmo type.
Turbo Man.
And at one point, through hijinks, he dresses up like Turbo Man mm-hmm. in like the suit.
Yeah.
And his son and his, it's like a Batman yeah. type disguise.
Well, no, it's not. It's, yeah. it's like just like a hood on his yeah. face and he's wearing sunglasses yeah. that yeah. are very see-through. Like, it's yeah. hilarious.
And they're like
know.
Interacting yeah. with him for a while.
Yeah.
The third act of the film.
yeah.
Yeah.
And at one point he takes a while and reveals it's him. And his son and his wife are like, what?
Yeah.
This dude's 6'7".
It's three, so yeah. funny.
I just thought Turbo Man was Austrian.
Yeah. The most recognizable so physique it's, and yeah, voice yeah. in the history of humans.
Oh, and shit, what's his name? Not
Sinbad.
Sinbad.
Sinbad's yeah, nice. Sinbad in his prime.
Yeah. It's so good. Definitely yeah. check it out.
Let's make Jingle All the Way. We got 1 year to do yep. it, folks. Yeah. By this time next year, Jingle All the Way will be a Christmas classic.
I hope so. It's
the
a great movie.
The only Christmas movie officially endorsed by the Pass Gas Podcast.
That part is true.
The Donut Podcast Network and Studio 71.
That is a really good movie.
And we're basically like Turbo Men.
We're basically Turbo Men.
Yeah.
Oh, Ooh. That's a cool name for a podcast. That's pretty good. It sounds old and new.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
If you're listening right now and you're good with Photoshop, make a logo and we'll see if we like the logo.
Yeah, even if you're mid at Photoshop.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, more.
Actually, that makes
more sense. Of those mid.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about some real life Turbo Man. How about okay. that?
Oh, nice segue.
It's time to talk about Cosworth. Mike Costin was born in 1929 in Hendon, UK. Growing up during World War II, Mike followed the lead of his brother Frank and studied aeronautical engineering. He enjoyed piloting light aircraft and gliders. This interest in aircraft led him to working for De Havilland Aircraft Company, though auto racing quickly caught Mike's attention. Mike developed his engineering skills at this company and moonlit as a race car driver, and a very talented one at that. Keith Duckworth later said of his skills, quote,
"Mike, I've never seen him overcorrect a car. When the back end goes, he just puts on the right amount of opposite lock at the right time. The car carries on sliding, and mysteriously as the curb approaches, it stops sliding and carries on in the right direction."
Awesome. Mike was introduced to Lotus cars by his friend, who owned and drove a Lotus Mark III B. This led to frequent visits by Costin to the Lotus factory in Hornsey, which is north of London.
This car.
It's sick.
It looks like a bug.
It looks like if Batman was.
Oh my God.
If they did like I've never a prequel, seen a car that looked like this. What?
If they did like a Batman prequel with his dad and he was kind of a Batman guy, like he would drive this.
You know what you would call this movie? What? It's like set in the 30s. You'd call it Detective.
Yeah.
This is like one of the this is the strangest looking car.
It's such a weird looking car. Listen, we look at cars for a living and I've never seen it looks like a bug from A Bug's Life.
It does look
It's very Pixar looking.
It's so sick.
And his license plate is Dank 420.
Yeah.
Nice.
This thing's sick. I love that paint.
At this time that Mike visited the Lotus factory in Hornsey. Nice. Lotus was looking to bolster their racing division by selling more Lotus 6s, and they were in desperate need of help at the factory. Mike was approached by a friend of Colin Chapman to work part-time building engines, and Mike agreed. For the next 2 years, Mike Costin split his time between De Havilland and Lotus, working on planes during the day, then racing engines at night. Quote,
"I actually built Colin's racing engine. But I also did the production engineering for the 6. I did all the thinking behind that. Colin didn't actually pay me any money. Oh, no, not Colin. But I got gallons and gallons of petrol instead."
This was just a little taste of Colin Chapman's unsavory business dealings. But if you want to know more about that, check out our whole episode on the man, episode 202.
I love Colin Chapman right out the gate. Right out of the gate, these quotes are fire.
Yeah, they're good.
These guys are talkers. Really, really talk good.
Keith Duckworth was a bit younger than Costin, born in 1933, but the trajectory of his career followed a similar path. Duckworth spent his early life attending the prestigious Giggleswick School.
Shut up.
Where he fell in love with everything mechanical. The prestigious Giggleswick Engineering School.
Prestigious Giggleswick. the hallowed halls of Giggleswick.
Giggleswick. Giggleswick, man.
He was a Ravenclaw.
Yeah.
Giggleswick. I majored in juggling at Giggleswick.
Yeah, for real.
I come from a long line of guys who stand on top of a ball. I studied at Giggleswick.
That's where I met Duckworth at Giggleswick.
I minored in the Teletubby studies at Giggleswick.
Giggleswick University.
This is crazy.
Professor Pee-wee Herman.
Keith was always hands-on and taught himself how to build model airplanes and even made a radio control that could work up to 2 miles away, which I guess he used to pilot planes. That's kind of cool. Keith used his inherent knowledge to question his teachers, which often got him in trouble. Quote,
"It was the first time that I actually went on my own analysis of a situation and came to my own conclusions."
2 + 2 = 5. he said this of his healthy skepticism.
"I can spot the bullshit factor from 100-yard range. If anyone makes a statement about a physical or mechanical phenomenon, I have a little automatic mechanism which says,
hang on, is that right? And then it starts another mechanism to work out what is right. It,
I love that. This attitude would land him in even more trouble.
So if I take this vaccine...
This attitude would land him in even more trouble when he joined the Royal Air Force. Duckworth's stint at the RAF was short-lived. He was initially denied entry to the pilot program, but eventually regraded into it. He flew a de Havilland Tiger Moth biplane and was inching closer to becoming an RAF pilot when he was suddenly thrown out for risky behavior. Quote,
I was then flung out for dangerous and incompetent night flying. I actually went to sleep in the circuit.
So he's falling asleep in his plane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After the Royal Air Force, Keith worked towards an engineering degree from the Imperial College of London. Oh, Joe just brought out a book.
I read this book in preparation for this. Yeah. I didn't write this script, but...
Sixth edition.
He was like flying his radio controlled things in a field and he twisted his ankle.
Uh-huh.
Then someone put some like sticky bandage on his ankle.
Okay.
But he was allergic to the glue in it. And so he got like super sick and couldn't sleep and then like, but needed to get his hours in the plane. And so like he kind of got screwed out because he only had like a couple hours left to get his certification or whatever.
Well, he should have been practicing the real flying instead of playing with his little airplanes.
I know. Yeah. It's kind of dumb.
How do you twist your ankle flying in an airplane?
Yeah, you're standing there.
Look, there's the mirrors on the Gulf.
Or oh, whoa. Car. That's sick. Are they from a race car?
No, I'm sure they just copied them.
Oh.
So yeah, after he got kicked out for flying his little airplane, Keith worked towards an engineering degree from the Imperial College of London, where he found a hobby in motorsport. He raced an Austin 7 at courses like Goodwood and Brands Hatch and eventually upgraded to a Lotus 6. Having learned from his mistakes with the Austin and never ready to settle for mediocrity, Keith decided that the Lotus had to be built with the best components. Duckworth went straight to the source, the Lotus headquarters. He ordered the Coventry Climax engine and an MG gearbox, which is the most expensive upgrades you could order at the time. They were 250 pounds.
Oh, what a world.
Yeah. During one of his many trips to Lotus is when Keith met Mike Costin, but it would still be a few more years before the two worked alongside each other at the Lotus factory.
Nice.
Duckworth graduated in 57 and started looking for mechanical work out in the field, but not the same field that he broke his ankle in.
No,
no, that's a bad field.
He interviewed at luxury automotive companies that also had aeronautic divisions like Napier and Rolls-Royce before the opportunity of a lifetime fell upon him. Graham Hill, who we now know as the two-time Formula One champion and all-around Riz King, was working as...
No.
I just read what's on the page.
I know you do. Yeah. Whoever put this in is... dead.
I did.
Whoever put this in is dead.
Graham Hill was working as the lead gearbox engineer at Lotus and was eyeing his departure from the company to focus on racing full time. Quote,
Graham Hill was about to leave Lotus. I went along to Lotus to see Colin Chapman and he offered me a job straight out of college as a gearbox development engineer.
Keith accepted Chapman's offer of £600 a year. Little did he know, this would be one of the most challenging assignments he would ever face. Just not in a mechanical sense.
We should do a subscription box for car people called Gearbox.
And we just send you bullshit.
That we buy wherever.
Like laser cut wood models of the Nürburgring.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. That's like one that you're like, oh, God, cool.
What am I supposed to do? Yeah, it's only this big. I can't display it.
But we like skimp on packaging, so it's broken it's by the time.
It's always broken.
Well, no, we take, here's what we do.
Yeah.
We take all the free swag that companies send us.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then we just send it out.
Yeah.
A tiny bucket hat that doesn't fit my enormous head.
Wow, I got a Toyo lanyard and Hankook socks.
Whoa, distressed Alpine Stars jeans?
Well, do we have this? I was like, I'll take those. I'll take some new jeans. All my jeans eventually just get so greasy and oily and disgusting.
You should have jeans here.
I feel like we're in a rare category of media personalities who have like work clothes and home clothes.
It sucks.
But my home clothes are my nice clothes. My
they eventually clothes just mix trash. Together and all get ruined. Yeah. And then it's like I have to buy more shirts. You know,
like I have pairs of shoes that I haven't worn just because I like buy them and then forget like, oh yeah, I can't wear them to work.
Yeah.
And you're at work all the time.
I'm at work all the time. Clocking, clocking,
I work
clocking,
all the time.
Clocking. Work all the time. For a living. Work all the, that's a shirt.
I'm at work yeah. all the time.
I'm a for a living. I'm a pretty woman. If there's one thing that you should know about Colin Chapman, it's that he was all about saving weight and money. If this is a man whose famous quotes include simplify, then add lightness, and the ominous, any car which holds together for a whole race is too heavy. This commitment to shaving pounds often backfired during the early days of Lotus. The queer box was the perfect example of this.
Okay.
That's a quote. Okay. I know I've said some stuff in my career that you guys like to point out, but I didn't write any of it. It was all given to me by other people. Chapman wanted it to be the smallest and lightest five-speed transmission possible. He gave it an especially low drive shaft line to accommodate a lower driving position, which dropped both the center of mass and overall air resistance of the race car. The problem was the gearbox would fail before the end of almost every race. Yeah, I'd say that's a problem. I mean, let's put it to a vote, fellas. Do you think that's a problem? Show of hands. 3-3, unanimous. It's a problem. Initially, the job of fixing it fell on Graham Hill, who found that the crown wheel pinion of the final drive would fail after only 50 miles, while the rest of the gearbox would wear down to the point of being unable to select gears, leaving drivers with the infamous box full of neutrals. With Duckworth on the job, finding and fixing the issues of the queer box was no issue. The two main problems with the box, Keith said, were that the gears had very short internal splines to locate the selected linkage, and that the crown wheel and pinion were not getting enough lubrication. I made up some shields and then some jets, convinced myself that oil would now get up to the gears, and that if we assembled it properly, that there was a fair chance it would work.
Everyone is Jeremy Clarkson.
The first test they did with the new setup worked flawlessly. Keith had fixed the gearbox without breaking a sweat. Not a single one. But paying for these upgrades, that was the real challenge. Chapman was unwilling to pay for the changes Duckworth felt were necessary to fix the transmission. And the conflict eventually led to tension between the engineers and Chapman. Maybe he just didn't have enough money and he's embarrassed to tell them. Despite Keith's failure to make headway at Lotus, the time he spent there was not in vain. He had found something utterly invaluable while working at the factory. A friendship with Mike Costin, who had risen to the position of technical director at Lotus and Colin Chapman's right-hand man. There is a fundamental thing about Mike and me. We are understanders. We think out how things actually work. What is quite remarkable about Mike is that he really understands what I'm about and what everything is about. And I am part of everything. When Duckworth made the decision to leave Lotus, he spent 2.5 hours systematically critiquing Chapman's business management style, his unwillingness to listen to reason and logic, his resistance to change, the lying, the manipulation. At the end of the meeting, Keith dropped the bomb that he and Mike Costin were starting a new company, but it turns out that Colin Chapman had one more manipulation up his sleeve. Chapman had heard rumblings of a new breakoff company started, and to get ahead of it, he made Mike Costin sign a 3-year non-compete work contract with Lotus, meaning that Costin couldn't leave. And if he did, then he couldn't compete. And any side work was forbidden. Forbidden.
You're forbidden.
You're forbidden.
You're quite forbidden, mate.
So the two ventured out on their own and founded Cosworth. Oh, it's the combination of their names,
mm-hmm.
which is a portmanteau of Coston and Duckworth. Cosworth. Huh. And Coston continued to work as a key Lotus engineer through 1962.
It just sounds like a word that should exist.
Yeah, Cosworth is
a
sick.
It's really
name.
Good.
Duckworth?
Better than Duxton.
Yeah. Duxton. Me Duxton's kind of sick, though. Duxton sounds like a...
Really Duxton sick. Sounds...
like an like outerwear company.
Or like a kid that moves to your sixth grade class.
Duxton.
Hey, Duxton. Or this like, is Duxton. Yeah,
like a monkey. Yeah. A monkey that checks into a hotel.
Duxton. Duxton checks in. Duxton.
Duxton. And then Duxton moves. Yeah, Duxton moves away after 2 years.
Yeah, you're like
his dad's
yeah,
in the army, yeah. So they're always moving
and then,
around.
Yeah. And then like 30 years later, you're like, I wonder what happened to Duxton.
I think about that all the time yeah. with like kids that I grew up with.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
It's like Facebook.
Some people are not on Facebook.
Yeah. My the one that I always think of. If you're out there, Derek,
we're hit calling me up, you dude. Out, dude.
We used to hang out. We used to talk about Darkwing Duck all the time.
All the time.
His mom, Deirdre, would drive us around and point out that if you connected all my freckles, you could find Darkwing Duck.
What? What, man? Did she connect all your freckles?
What?
Did she ever connect your freckles?
No, but she said he could if you drew a little line.
If you let me.
Yeah.
If you let me.
Deirdre, what the hell?
What the hell, Deirdre? Deirdre, what? What, Deirdre?
So anyway, Derek, what's up,
Derek
man?
Dudley, hit us up and tell us what the F your mom is
yeah,
all
what
about.
Are you doing, man?
Deirdre?
You guys must have talked about Darkwing Duck
so much.
Well, they if you hadn't noticed, they love alliterations with D's.
Yeah.
So, like, every Derek, Deirdre, Darkwing.
Derek, Deirdre, okay. Darkwing Duck. I yeah. am the terror that flies in the night. Pass Gas will be right back. Commercial time. Now, because of Colin Chapman's last-minute slight, the two were forced to produce parts exclusively for Lotus until Coston's contract expired. During that time, Coston played a part in the development of everything from the Lotus 15 through the Lotus 26, a list that includes the Lotus 18, because that's how numbers work. The company's first mid-engine single-seater.
Oh.
It also included the Lotus 25, the company's first F1 world champion. And the Lotus Elan, a.k.a. the car that inspired the Miata.
Nice.
One of them.
One of them. At the time, yeah, it's the Lotus Elan and Bigfoot.
The monster truck?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
I love the monster
more
truck.
More from like Bigfoot. A spiritual place.
Yeah.
I just typed in Bigfoot monster. It's a monster truck.
It's like, yeah, it's like, it'll be small like the Lotus Elan. It's like, yeah, but it's got to have the heart of Bigfoot. Okay, yeah, Chris.
Yeah, man.
Okay, it will. Yeah. It will have the heart of Bigfoot. Yeah.
I like the blue on a Bigfoot. Yeah. Can we make a blue Miata?
Okay, Chris. Yeah.
Oh, man.
At the same time, Coston was moonlighting at Cosworth with Duckworth, already laying the groundwork for the revolution to come. Initially, their work was done exclusively on Ford Kent engines for Lotus, a sub-2-liter inline four, largely modifying the cylinder heads with improved camshafts. This led to success in Formula Junior, but also provided power to an early version of the Lotus 7. However, it was the work they do leading up to 1965 on the MAE, the Modified Anglia Engine, that would really start the Cosworth story in earnest. goes to camp. Here, they replace the side draft intake ports of the head with downdraft carbs brazed onto the cast iron head, allowing gravity to help in the process of delivering the air-fuel mixture into the combustion chamber.
What does braised mean?
So, like, it's like welding, beef. But not... It doesn't use, like, an electric arc. It's...
Oh.
It's, like...
Just straight-up heat?
Heat, yeah.
Okay.
Heat?
Like braised rib, braised short ribs.
I used to work at the Dairy Queen Brazier.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I'd with my friends. They'd come in for, you know, Blizzard.
Yeah.
I'd put chili in it.
Shut up. Yeah. That's sick.
Yeah.
There's chili in here. What the hell, Joe? God, dude.
I said, I gotcha. I'll make you a new one.
The company's like, why are we spending so much money at the Brazier location on chili and ice cream?
All right. All this braising of the cylinder heads allowed the 105E engine, which delivered only 39 horsepower upon its debut, to punch out over 100 horsepower per liter reliably.
Per liter. Well,
that's an improvement of over 250%. The MAE dominated Formula Junior and Formula 3 until new regulations prevented its use in 1968.
Ah, man, that's how it always happens, right?
I know.
You make it so good, and then they're like,
not allowed.
No.
Not allowed. Sorry, baby.
Yeah.
Finally, the two had a bit of freedom to implement their own designs and innovations to make better, faster, stronger, higher revving engines that were more reliable. Without limitations, the pair's true genius shined, as well as their admiration for each other. I like how much they talk about how they liked each other in this.
That's this whole book. Is that like
buds?
Mike Costin was so bloody smart.
That's so cool. I feel like that's not a thing that we do these days. Nobody gives each other props.
No.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, yeah, he's pretty good, but like, I did it too. I was there too. It's because we're all getting screwed all the time. You feel like you gotta speak up for yourself. No one else is gonna do it. As Mike recalled, Keith could take anything from start to finish, from concept to layout, to the design details, to making prototype bits, to assembling it himself, to showing how it would work and understanding the principles involved. He was totally sold. He was the brightest I had ever come across. Colin couldn't stand this bloke was so bright. And similarly, Keith said of Mike, I thought Mike was supremely capable. We actually are a brilliant pair. He is still a racing mechanic by nature, whereas I tend to think too long.
You need that yin yang.
You need that yin yang.
You do need that yin yang.
Yeah.
Where do you see Monday?
Until now, Cosworth was operating as a subsidiary of Lotus, but they were ready for the next step in their evolution. Independence. This is before America.
Yeah.
This is 1968. This
predates America by quite a long time. This is 8 years
before America.
What are we going to do for the 50th anniversary of America?
I don't know, man.
1976, baby.
In the 1960s, Ford was serious about racing. This is the era that brought us Shelby, the Cobra Daytona, and the GT40. But that was all on this side of the pond. Over in England, Ford of Europe was working just as hard to establish a new performance era. And Walter Hayes, the head of public affairs at Ford of England and the man responsible for the GT40, was looking to make a big old splash.
A big old splash
in the pond. I think it's so cheeky when they call it a pond because it's really an ocean.
It's really big. Ocean. It's a lot it's bigger than a pond.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Oh, you too?
Downplay much?
Yeah. At the same time, Lotus had lost its contract with Coventry Climax, who had previously provided the engines for Lotus race cars. In 1965, the FIA decided that after 1966, the maximum engine capacity for Formula One would increase from 1.5 to 3 liters.
That's double.
and Coventry wasn't interested in producing the larger engine, so Chapman turned to his old friends over at Cosworth. Lotus knew that in order to win in F1, they need a big old V8, but engine development was and is anything but cheap. Toyota famously spent over $1 billion developing the Lexus LS430.
We should figure out another engine that costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because this is the only one we ever use.
I know. Well, because it costs $400 million.
Yeah, it was a lot.
Yeah. That is a lot of money.
It is.
When Chapman first approached Duckworth about building him a revolutionary new V8 made from scratch, Duckworth knew he could make it happen. He just needed the money. But it was money that Lotus didn't have.
God, that's
I need money,
all
but
needed.
That's all I don't have.
Yeah, well, he just needed the money.
Yeah.
But that's the one thing they didn't have?
That's it.
Oh!
What are they going to do? Figure out a solution.
But the, all they need is money, then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't they have money?
No.
Oh, that's the one thing they don't have.
They don't have.
Oh,
we went over this.
Well, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a huge problem.
That's what we're saying. Yeah. It's a big problem, I'd say. If the one thing that they need is the money, that's all they need.
Thing they don't
but.
Well, they're good then, right?
No. No. No, 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 no. Listen. Listen.
It's what? The one thing that they don't have.
Oh, my God. What?
Yeah.
Yeah, dude.
They're screwed.
Isn't this crazy?
Yeah. God. Pack it up. Pack it up. I'm sure the next paragraph is going to be, so they gave up. They went home.
Actually.
Ordered a pizza.
No, check this out.
What?
Chapman contacted Ford at Dearborn, Michigan, as well as Aston Martin to try to secure funding. Money.
Oh, ask guys so they're for good money?
That's another word for money is funding.
They're good.
Okay,
then,
so
right?
They're trying.
Well, neither of the companies are interested.
Oh, come on.
That's what they needed.
That's all they needed.
Nah, I know.
The one thing they didn't have.
They couldn't get it.
From Ford?
From Ford.
Did they ask them?
They did.
Aston Martin? Did they ask
Aston
them?
Aston Martin, too, yeah.
That's the second one I was going to ask.
Chapman's old friend, though, Walter Hayes, was intrigued.
Oh.
Just a few years earlier, they'd collaborated on the Lotus Cortina, a car that was a huge success both on the track and in the showroom.
I love it. It's a little square car. Yeah.
And together, along with Harley Koop, the British-based American engineer who masterminds Ford's explosion into NASCAR in the 50s, this team came up with a strategy to conquer Formula One together.
Harley Koop is a cool name.
Harley Koop.
You're not going to believe this, guys, but suddenly Cosworth was flush with cash.
What?
Oh!
But money wasn't the only benefit this partnership would afford. Previously, demand
That's
for
That's the one thing they needed.
Yeah, now they got it.
Nice.
Previously, demand for Cosworth's engines was so high that they were having trouble keeping up. And as a result, the majority of MAE engines were sold as kits where the customer did the assembly. But with Ford now in the mix, remember, Walter Hayes was the PR guy for Ford of Europe.
Yeah.
Cosworth was responsible for the development of the engines, and Ford would take care of the manufacturing. So Ford would build them, Cosworth designed them.
That's great for That's Cosworth.
Good. Yeah. Now, Cosworth could concentrate solely on their strongest asset, design, and the plan was put in place. In fact, as far as Cosworth was concerned, it had already begun.
It had already begun.
So they're already doing better than Lotus. Basically,
I guess. Back in 1964, Cosworth had developed the SCA, which was a 1-liter, 2-valve, single overhead cam, 4-cylinder engine based on the Cortina's 116E block, and it was intended for Formula 2. It featured the first 100% Cosworth design head. It had a forged crankshaft. It had steel main bearing caps and pistons. Steel pistons, wow. And a head gasket with all metal O-rings so it could run at a higher compression. Additionally, the intake ports and oil pickup in the dry sump were both canted over 25 degrees because Lotus wanted to mount the engine at a 25-degree angle for a lower center of gravity. That's pretty sick.
That is sick.
I love that.
Yeah.
With the engine at an angle, the intake ports and oil pickup were now faced straight up and down.
That's cool.
Yeah. It is cool.
Yeah.
But there was a problem.
What? Another one?
Yeah. The SCA featured a reverse flow design in the head, meaning the intake and exhaust ports were on the same side of the engine. That means the air has to go in, and then when it's making a U-turn to get out.
And you need to put a bunch of crap on each of those.
It's not efficient. It doesn't flow very well.
You need to put throttle body, intake stuff, like throttle body or carbs.
If your grandpa has like an old slant six, like Mopar engine, or I think the Ford slant six is also this way, you'll see where the intake manifold goes on, and then you have to like snake the exhaust in between the openings.
That's probably not great for temperature either.
No, it heats up your intake
air
as well.
Hot air very intake, hot. More like.
That's
and
true.
Hot air isn't as dense as cold air.
That's
which
true.
Which means less power, baby.
Yes, sir.
This engine sucks.
This led to several limitations, mostly in spacing. With two Weber downdraft sand cast carburetors.
Dude, you never want to stand downdraft from Weber.
Nice.
Him and Pumbaa.
I had Vindaloo for lunch.
The SCA was able to put out
Snake Vindaloo.
The SCA was able to put out only 115 horsepower from 997 cubic centimeters.
That's good.
That's decent.
So 1 liter.
Yeah.
That's pretty decent.
That thing is pretty high.
I mean,
though.
This is the 60s. Yeah. The early 60s. That's great.
That thing was a screamer, though.
Yeah.
But it could be better.
That's not like a Honda Civic four cylinder.
It could be better, though.
Yeah.
With the addition of Lucas fuel injection in 1966,
so now we got a throttle body.
It was bumped up to 140 horsepower, but to push that number any higher would require some serious modifications. And in the 60s, taking your ideas from theory to reality meant you had to actually build it yourself.
That's think what about, it means now, too.
1 liter making 140 horsepower is really good.
Yeah.
Pretty good, yeah.
I bet that thing was like,
Definitely, but it's going to get even louder.
I bet that thing screamed like a stuck snake.
I'm stuck! Cosworth would land on one of their more...
Wait, did you just... Snakes don't make noise, and they also don't get stuck.
That would cause one to scream.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. That's the...
That's probably why I never
heard
it.
That's why it's an old-timey saying.
Really?
Snakes don't get stuck and they don't scream. Can you imagine if they did? It must be a pretty scary situation.
Yeah. Be like, I'm really stuck.
Yeah.
Ah!
Yeah. That thing screams. That engine screams like a stuck snake.
This is where Cosworth would land on one of their more truly unique innovations, something they continue to do to this very day. Proving an engine design works by building only half of it at a time.
But
they realized that the concepts that would make a hypothetical V8 successful
could
be proven by building a fantastic inline four engine and then doubling it.
That's sick.
That's what they do that a lot now.
Yeah. The first stage of this two-pronged attack, a temporal pincer, if you will, if you're a Tenet fan, Christopher Nolan, resulted in the FV8, the four-valve Type A engine. It utilized the cross-flow head designed for the Cortina and modified it for use in Formula 2. So now they actually, instead of the air-fuel mixture having to do that U-turn in and out of the motor, now it's right across
much
the head.
Much better.
Much more efficient. We already said that. At 1.6 liters, it had 16 valves, so it's moving a lot of air, dual overhead cams, and delivered an astonishing 220 horsepower at 9,000 RPM.
The same now space. We're talking.
Dude, it's like a freaking... K24.
Yeah, dude. This is when
it's smaller. It's even smaller.
Yeah, dude. 1.6 liter, 16 valve, four cylinder, dual overhead cam. I'm starting to recognize this Cosworth. Mm-hmm. This is the Cosworth I see on Facebook Marketplace.
Yeah, so that power figure was pretty amazing for the time.
9,000 RPM.
Yeah,
dude.
For reference, one of the most popular British sports cars of the era, the MGB, was delivering short of 100 horsepower from a larger 1.8 liter engine with a red line of just 6,000 RPM.
Oh, snooze fest. I bet this four-valve Type A engine screams like a stuck snake.
Oh, yeah.
What allows it to rev that high? Is it just like stronger internals?
I would imagine so. And I mean, and now it's pumping more air too. So like
pumping more air. It's got healthier spinny bits. I mean, it's really top to tails.
With the FVA, the concept had been
tongue
proven.
To tail. You
tongue
still doing
tail.
Snake euphemisms?
Yeah.
With the FVA, the concept had been proven. It was time for Cosworth to change the game once more.
Would you would you say that a snake has a tail?
A snake is a tail.
The whole body is a tail?
Yeah.
I don't know, man. This is the kind of philosophical inquiry you can only find on Past Gas.
A snake is a human tail. A snake is a human tail?
Yeah. What is a human tail?
A snake.
Oh, so they come from humans. They just fall off and then they start being their own animal?
I think that's what the Bible said, probably.
This is what an FBA sounds like.
Dang. That's a four cylinder?
That's a lot of mechanical chatter.
Yeah.
Let's get up to 9K. What's that, 4,500?
I don't know. That's the clip.
That's not 9K.
That was from 12 years ago.
Damn. It sounds like shit.
Top comment. That didn't go too well then.
No.
Like?
That thing as donut?
No kidding. Oh, maybe. I should.
Yeah, comment okay. As donut.
Doing it. More of that story right after this. We got to pay the bills.
What they came up with was eventually nicknamed the Messiah Engine. And the nickname made sense. The car it debuted in, the Lotus 49, would go on to change Formula One forever. The engine itself would dominate the sport for the next 17 years, winning at its very first outing in 1967 and remaining a commanding force until the turbo era hit its stride in 1983, prompting a frustrated Duckworth to comment, "Turbochargers are for people who can't build engines."
Wow.
Nice, dude.
Sounds like he can't build his engine.
Oh, damn, Nolan.
Beaten, if he's getting beaten.
Dude, he throwed some shade and you were like, you throw shade? Well, call me Mr. Umbrella.
I just say, I mean, this is pretty typical. Didn't Ferrari say that aerodynamics are also for people who can't build engines?
That's always someone who's like, damn it.
Damn, I got beat. That's because they can't build a thing that powers the thing that beat me.
No, but the thing that I was doing before was good for me.
Yeah, there's no replacement for displacement.
That's why'd you have to think of a new thing that I'm not the best at?
Unfair. Ban that.
Unfair and also lame? The Lotus 49's dominance was largely due to something Colin Chapman held very close to his heart. Its lightness and rigidity. While teams like Ferrari and BRM were sticking with V12 and H16 engines, respectively, damn. H16, a flat 16 boy, Justin would nut. Can you imagine how hard Justin would nut if we showed him a H16? A big old flat engine with eight cylinders coming straight out of each side?
Yeah.
Justin would nut. Dude, how hard would Justin nut?
I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah.
This thing is crazy. It's huge, though.
Oh, my God. Don't show that picture to Justin. He'd nut.
I'm going to need to wipe my screen off after I show it to Justin.
Yeah, because he's going to nut. How wide is that thing? That thing's sick. Dude,
only 4 inches wide.
We got to put that in Justin Subaru. He's nuts. Chapman's design for the Lotus 49, which was developed for and in conjunction with this new engine, called for a small V8 to keep things as light as possible. More importantly, the entire design centered around using the engine itself as a structural member of the car. Hell yeah, dude. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hell yeah?
Hell yeah.
That's pretty tight. TVH? That's TAH.
That's super ahead of the time.
That is hell. Yeah. That's sick. I love that.
Yeah.
Eliminating the need for a rear... You know what that does? It eliminates the need for a rear subframe.
Oh, whoa, dude. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, now that you say that.
Yeah, I colloquialized it. This meant that while the larger engines could theoretically deliver more power, they'd also be heavier and less structurally sound.
Mm.
Chapman knew this to be true because he was losing the 1966 season while using a BRM H16.
You idiot.
To him, this just proved the idea that adding power makes you faster on the straights. Subtracting weight makes you faster everywhere. Ooh. That's his quote.
I love that.
Yeah. This dude's full of quotes. He's
I've heard that quote.
He's a slick talker.
I've heard that quote.
Reading this book made me really not like him.
Yeah.
He's super manipulative. He lied to everyone.
Really? He seems kind of Reddity. He talks like a Redditor.
No, he's way slicker
power,
than Redditor.
Adding power makes you faster on the straight. Subtracted weight makes you faster everywhere.
He would have loved r/cars for sure.
Actually, adding power makes you faster in the straights. Subtracting power makes you faster everywhere.
I'm thinking about getting my first car. Should I get a BRM H16?
No. No. Too big. I used my
not enough power.
No. Too much power because adding power you do. That's all the straights. Subtracting power makes you faster everywhere. On top of that, because the engine wouldn't be covered up by the tubes of the frame, it would be easier to work on before and especially during the race. While the Lotus 49 is often cited as the first car to utilize the engine as a stress member of the car, this actually isn't true. Cars like the Lancia D50 played with this concept to a degree back in 1954, and Ferrari used it wholly with the 158 in 1964 before abandoning it in 1966.
Take that to your trivia night.
Yeah, take that to some very specific bar trivia. But the difference between those cars and the Lotus? Lotus got it right. As Duckworth was famous for saying, in engineering, there is an answer to everything. It's just what we're usually too ignorant or too dim to see. After the explosive debut of the Lotus 49, the, quote, engine as a stress member of the car design would become the configuration for Formula One, something that continues to this very day.
Dude, dim is a very underused insult.
What are you, dim?
Insult. Yeah.
Oh, it's so, that hurts.
Yeah.
It hurts your feelings, you know?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Some of the, your feelings may never heal after hearing something like that.
Dude, being called dim, what are you, dim?
No.
Yeah. Because it kind of feels like
what does that mean? And then it takes you a second to like catch up. Right.
The light in my head's not very bright.
And then you're already behind, you know, like.
It's like more polite than calling someone stupid.
Oh, yeah.
So that they think you're so stupid that they're being nice to you.
Pretty good.
Yeah. But it wasn't just the layout that was responsible for the dominance of the Lotus 49. It was the engine itself. Labeled the DFV for double four valve.
Okay.
That's exactly what it was. Two FVA engines connected by a common crankshaft. The first of the FVAs hit the dyno in February of 1966, and by August of the same year, development was complete, allowing Duckworth to dive headfirst into his money bin.
As a duck does.
Allowing Duckworth to dive headfirst into his V8 project. A short 7 months later, the DFVs were ready for testing.
Cool.
At the time, the DFV was legendary. Dual overhead cams, 32 valves, over square design.
Wow, so the...
Huge.
That's why I can rev really high.
Yeah, so that means the width of the piston is longer than the...
It's a chode.
Yeah, it's longer than the...
So
the
fatter than
connector
tall?
Rod.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hamburger.
Yeah.
Okay, so SR20s have a square like piston.
Perfect square.
Yeah, they're like equal.
Yeah.
And that is like one of the reasons people like that engine so much is because the torque and the horsepower are very close to each other. So does... over square mean that there's like, is that?
So this is from VikingBags.com.
Oh, nice.
I go there all the time.
Viking Bags.
Oversquare engines have a wider cylinder and produce high RPM and power output. Undersquare engines.
So higher output, less torque.
Yeah. Undersquare engines have longer cylinders and produce low RPM and more torque.
That's
why,
like, diesel engines have long cylinders.
Yeah.
They're very torquey.
Yeah, because they're like this.
Yeah.
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 And then undersquares.
Yeah. Yeah.
More
leverage on that crankshaft.
More leverage on the crankshaft. Just to review, it had dual overhead cams, 32 valves.
That's a lot.
Oversquare design, which means higher RPMs, higher output.
Yes, sir.
A typical 90-degree V8, aluminum blocking head, direct injection, and Lucas mechanical fuel injection.
Nice.
So it was just pumping gas right into the
cylinder.
Pumping and dumping. That's
direct
right.
injection is pretty cool for that era.
Yeah, it is.
Pretty advanced.
Has there ever been an engine with more than four valves per cylinder?
Yeah, mine.
I have five. Five valve.
Yeah. 20 valve Volkswagen engines.
Oh, yeah, because it's a four cylinder. I never thought of that.
Yeah, so like a 1.8T is a four cylinder with five.
Yeah. Sorry, it's just a moment of dimness on my part.
No, that's fine. That's a good question.
At 400 horsepower, it wasn't the most powerful engine in the field, but it was not dim, light. The engine and the lack of extra structural components to support it meant that the entire car came in very close to Formula One's minimum weight restriction.
Formula Mum.
You guys know what I mean. Give me a break.
Formula Mum.
Wait, the weight restriction was 1,100 pounds?
Wow.
A 400 horsepower engine in an 1,100 pound car.
Man, that's hauling ass, dude.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I mean, that's kind of the point, gentlemen.
I know, but this is like so. Yeah.
It's kind of the point, huh? Formula Mum, don't mess around. This gave the Lotus 49 an advantage over other cars, which were 200 to 300 pounds heavier at the time. It was the ultimate manifestation of the famous Duckworth quote, "Working things for yourself from the first principles and providing proper engineering solution never goes out of fashion." That's a famous quote.
That's that famous quote, dude.
When I think of Duckworth, I think of that quote.
"Working things for yourself from first principles and providing proper engineering solutions never goes out of fashion."
Oh, when
no
I hear that.
Fear. I got that on a shirt. But there is one thing standing in its way. It still hadn't been tested.
Wilson,
get off my plane.
The spring of 1967 was a wet one.
Yeah, it was.
Meaning that by the time the car and engine made their debut at Zandvoort, sporting Ford proudly on the valve covers, driver Graham Hill had managed only 1.5 days of testing. His partner Jim Clark, fresh from Indianapolis, and just 2 years after winning the 500 in the first rear-engine car in history, the Lotus 38, sat in the car for the very first time on June 1st. Over the next few days, the team ironed out the many changes and the fixes the car needed, but the engine ran better than expected, and with 400 horsepower, it was producing more power than the Ferrari V12 at the time, with four fewer cylinders.
Wow.
Even with many details left to iron out, what if Ferrari was like, V8s are for people who can't build engines? Hill managed to set a lap record in qualifying, finishing 6 seconds faster than the previous record and snagging pole position. Good.
I think that's a pretty good test.
Yeah. Come race day, Graham jumped out in the lead and stayed there for the next 10 laps before a broken camshaft took him out of the race. That's a bummer. Clark, on the other hand, still getting used to the new car he'd only met 3 days before, took another 5 laps to get acquainted with the little Lotus before snatching the lead and holding on to it for the final 74 laps of the race, finishing an incredible 27 seconds ahead of the rest of the field. He was a regular Max Verstappen out
there. At Zandvoort?
Regular Max Verstappen.
And while reliability problems would mean that Clark would only be able to secure three more wins for the rest of the season, leaving him 10 points behind Denny Hulme in the Drivers' Championship, the writing was on the wall. The engine as a stressed member configuration would soon be the standard in Formula One rather than the outlier.
That'd be really disheartening to be at the first race of the season and see someone win by 27 seconds.
Yeah, I wonder what that's like.
Yeah, it's so crazy that that ever happened in Formula One. And hope it doesn't happen again.
That would suck. That would make it not fun to watch anymore. Up to this point, Ford, Lotus, and Cosworth had an exclusive relationship. They were exclusive. Nice. Finally.
I didn't think they wanted to put labels on it, but I guess.
But after witnessing the performance of the DFV in 67, Ford decided that for 68, it would offer the engine for sale to the rest of the field. For £7,500, the equivalent of $220,000 today, anyone could walk away with a giant killer. Is that really the exchange rate? That's crazy.
That's a lot.
Maybe £75,000. I don't know. That's a lot. If you wanted to buy an F1 engine today, the sticker would be closer to $10 million for comparison. So unsurprisingly, many people opted in. At times, the entire field was powered by DFVs, with the exception of stubborn old Ferrari.
Yep.
And over the course of the next 262 starts, a DFV-powered car would take the win 155 times. Wow. Over this period, Cosworth continued to upgrade the DFV, including adding a turbo in 1975 to create the DFX.
Yes.
Doubling the horsepower of the stock DFV and becoming the dominant engine. You like your Cosworth V8s, don't you, Joe?
This DFX is like one of my favorite engines of all time.
You actually bring it up quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it doubled the horsepower of the stock DFV, becoming the dominant engine in IndyCar until the 80s. Its longevity was partially because it was very well designed, partially because it was affordable, and partially because of a bit of luck. Because as F1 entered the ground effect era, the DFV suddenly found itself with a new advantage.
Do you want to know my dream build project car?
I'd love to.
I get a DFX from the 80s. It's, you know, got 10 miles on it or something. Yeah. It's still in the crate.
Yeah, still in the box, yeah.
Then I get a Nissan Cube and I put it in the back of it.
Hell yeah. Make it happen.
Yeah.
Make it happen. As the late 70s arrived, just when an engine like the DFV would be entering the twilight of its career, Colin Chapman dropped another little trick to inject new life into the Messiah engine. Ground effects, which is when the air underneath the car sucks the car to the ground, as opposed to being pushing the car into the ground with wings on top of the car.
Yeah.
When the DFV debuted, Formula One cars still looked like missiles with wheels. They were gorgeous, but they lacked something crucial, and that was downforce. Chapman began experimenting with developing cars with side skirts to hide Venturi tunnels running along the underside of the car, creating a low-pressure area that would suck the car onto the track. And while the compact V-shaped DFV was perfect for this design, the flat 12s and 16s the competition was using meant there were cylinders where the tunnels needed to be. So once again, Chapman's designs won the day, and the DFV would soldier on to take pole positions in its third and fourth decade. It last scored points in F1 for Tyrrell in 1990 and even showed up in 2013 at the Brazilian Grand Prix.
What?
Didn't even know that car? I have no clue. It also won Le Mans a couple times as well, once for Mirage in 75 and once for Rondeau in 1980.
Rondeau.
It seemed there was no style of racing that Cosworth couldn't conquer. The company born in 1958, and 10 years later, the DFV had proven they can do more than just modify engines. They could design and dominate, and they were far from done. As Cosworth moved through the next few centuries, they only solidified their legacy in the automotive world. Which is something we'll talk about next week in part two, conclusion of Cosworth.
We'll get to my whale tail Sierra Cosworth.
My whale tail Sierra Cosworth. That Sierra's got a real whale tail.
Okay, so the cars that they ran in 2013 that the DFV was in the for Marussia, which was
that's how you say that?
Marussia, yeah.
And it's Jules Bianchi, rest in peace.
Yeah, and Max Chilton, who's still running in, I believe, in IndyCar.
Wow.
I believe old Max Chilton is still over there.
We got some really good listener mail this week from Justin.
Oh, dude, if Justin saw that age 16.
What's up, donation?
Okay. Oh, that's pretty cool.
Right, that is cool. Right. For days now, I have been chatting the gases, the food, oils, the blood. I think he meant to say chanting. From part two of the Mercedes episode. It made me want to make a list of the anatomy of a vehicle. Feel free to change my list or add your input. Truly juiced up to be here. Toot, toot, baby, toot, toot. And Nolan, it might have just been turkey day, but I hope you gave it the goose.
Oh, nice. I sure did.
So he says, Justin
felt
says,
like shit. No, sorry.
Gas is the food.
Yeah.
Gas tank is the tummy.
Okay. Yeah.
The grill, nose, nostrils, meaning the air intake would be the nasal passage.
Yeah. Okay.
The bumpers are the knuckles. This is a good one, right?
Okay.
It kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Axles are the legs.
Yes.
Wheels would be the feet. Tires would be the shoes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Windshield is the eyes.
Yeah, of course.
Computer and electronics are the
headlights
brain.
Aren't the eyes?
He's going for like a Pixar Cars kind of methodology, it sounds like, rather than like those old Mobile One commercials where the headlights were the eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you see with both. An argument can be made either way.
Yeah. Maybe the lights are the glasses.
Yeah.
Computer and electronics are the brain. The coolant is the sweat keeping the car cool. That's we've all agreed
on
that.
Interesting.
Chassis is the spine.
Okay.
Almost like a turtle.
Sure. No, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. And the body is the bones.
The body is the bones, dude.
The body is the bones.
The motor is the heart. Paint is the skin. Exhaust system is the lower intestine. Yeah. Exhaust tip is the butthole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oil is the blood.
Oil's the blood.
That all checks out, right?
I love it. Great job.
You know what I thought of yesterday?
Oh, okay.
You know what the ankle is?
What?
The CV joint.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And Max says that the trailing arms are the knees.
Sure.
Sure.
Well, that's been the show.
Bye.
Join us next week for Cosworth Part 2. Follow James at James Pumphrey. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber, where you'll find a little picture of a little baby growing
up in the attic.
A bun in the oven.
Bun in the oven.
Joe's
going to
be a father. I don't think we announced that the last time we recorded.
No.
He told us off air before we started.
We find out things before you.
Yeah. Cool. Just find out it's going to be a little boy. So,
what?
Yeah. Wow. I get to teach him car stuff.
Yeah, nice. I'm going to make him a massage. And
you're like, the greatest car in the world is the Nissan Cube, son. And someday, I'm going to buy you one. That's why your name's Cube, son.
Yeah. Women are too emotional to be in positions of power.
What is this? Season 6 of Survivor, James? All right, that's been the show. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
If she gets her period, we'll go to war.
Oh, my God.